Chapter 23 East and West. Archaeology took different paths of development in Asia and Europe, in East and West. Some 2,000 years ago, Chinese historians worked to trace historical events back to at least 3,000 BC, and the three major dynasties of rulers in the north, Chia, Shang, and Zhou. They charted the various conflicts and the rise and fall of small kingdoms, until finally, in 221 BC, the country was unified under the first Chinese emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi. See Chapter 31. The Chinese realized that their history was complex and constantly evolving, that dynasties came and went, but that civilization endured. In this, they were helped by the distinctive Chinese writing system, which dates back to around 1500 BC. It had originated in picture symbols, but gradually developed into a script that was widely used by government officials after 500 BC. For the most part, Europe had a different experience of history. Written records there began with the Romans and with the conquest of Gaul, France, by Julius Caesar in 54 BC. Anything earlier can only be studied using archaeological methods. For example, the three-age system and the research of Oscar Montelius and others documented prehistoric times after the Ice Age. See Chapter 11. Instead of relying on written records, European archaeologists refined their excavation and survey methods, paying close attention to such small objects as brooches and pins. China's scholars were curious about their remote history well over 2,000 years ago, and there was enduring interest in the history of the ancient civilizations. Archaeology in China began with a passion for collecting, with the prestige that came from owning fine objects from the past. Antiquarians were active as early as the Song Dynasty, AD 960 to 1279. From then on, Chinese emperors habitually collected fine antiquities. For centuries, farmers in northern China unearthed ancient animal bones of all kinds in their fields, calling them dragon bones. They ground up the fossil fragments to make medicines. In 1899, some inscribed bones came into the hands of Wang Yurong, Chancellor of the Imperial Academy in Beijing. Wang collected ancient bronzes and realized that the script used on the bones was identical to that on some Zhao Dynasty vessels, among the earliest in China. In 1908, Liu Xinyu, an antiquarian and language expert, translated some of the bone inscriptions and traced them to Anyang in the Yellow River Valley, capital of the ancient Shang Dynasty, one of the earliest Chinese civilizations. Excavations at Anyang by archaeologist Li Ji from 1928 to 1937 recovered 20,000 inscribed bone fragments, ox shoulder blades. These were oracle bones that had been heated, then cracked with hot metal pointers. Priests interpreted the cracks as divine messages and added the inscriptions. When translated, the inscriptions turned out to be prophecies performed for or by the Shang royal household. They covered everything from health to agriculture and prospects of victory in war. Li Ji also excavated 11 Shang royal tombs and discovered numerous priceless bronzes. Except for the excavations at Zhoku Dian near Beijing, which yielded bones of Homo erectus, see Chapter 8. In the early days of modern archaeology, most excavations were in the hands of non-Chinese explorers, or a few local private archaeologists who worked on their own. Most of them operated in northwestern China, Mongolia, and Tibet. The most famous of these scholars was Oriel Stein, 1862 to 1943. An explorer, obsessive traveler, and archaeologist, Stein was one of the last true archaeological adventurers. Born in Budapest, as a teenager, he displayed considerable intellectual talent. His Hungarian military training also gave him an eye for landscape and expertise in surveying. Like other archaeologists working in remote lands, Stein had an exceptional flair for languages, which enabled him to travel widely in little-known Central Asia. Except for the ancient Silk Road and other trade routes, this was virtually a geographical blank in the Western world. The Silk Road was a network of trade routes across Central Asia that linked China and the West. Stein joined the Indian Education Service in 1887, but transferred to the Indian Archaeological Survey in 1910. By then, he had already penetrated deep into remote country on the Chinese and Indian borders. There, he investigated the mysterious Khotan Empire, an early center for the spread of Buddhism from India to China. Khotan had grown rich on the Silk Road trade during the 8th century AD. Stein's major interest was in artifacts and sacred books that were being sold to European collectors. Between 1906 and 1913, Stein vanished into the least accessible parts of China. He visited the caves of the Thousand Buddhas, where painted sculptures had been carved into sandstone at Dunhuang in the far west of China. Chinese monks had established the earliest shrine in the caves in AD 306. Eventually, there were 492 temples at what had become an important junction of the Silk Road. Some 45,000 square meters of wall art adorn the caves, some of the earliest Chinese art known. Stein heard rumors of a collection of ancient manuscripts, and a monk showed him a sealed chamber crammed with documents of all kinds. These were Chinese versions of Buddhist texts written between the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. Many were designed to be hung in shrines. Stein bought the entire collection, plus another 7 cases of manuscripts and more than 300 paintings, for 4 silver horseshoes. He discreetly packed everything onto his camels and ponies and spirited the collection away to the British Museum. Though Stein has been criticized for his dishonest looting, he did manage to save numerous priceless artifacts of early Buddhism and ancient Central Asian culture from being sold on the open market. Quite apart from Stein's collecting activities, the Indian Archaeological Survey supported his expeditions and long absences as a way of gathering vital geographical and political information. Between 1913 and 1916, he penetrated deep into Mongolia and traced long stretches of the Silk Road. By now, though, he faced competition from other archaeologists and suspicion from officials. Despite these difficulties, Stein returned with another rich haul of manuscripts, jade artifacts, and fine pottery, all purchased at the lowest possible price or collected from the surface of deserted sites. Stein stayed constantly on the move in remote parts of Central Asia until he was well into his 70s. During the 1920s, he scoured little-known regions of Persia and Iraq for cultural links to the Indus cities of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, see Chapter 25. As late as the 1940s, he was mapping the remote eastern frontiers of the Roman Empire. Almost single-handedly, this remarkable traveler linked the ancient East and West. To the Chinese, who regard him as a thief, his methods were questionable, but he opened the eyes of Western archaeologists and historians to the huge blank that had been Central Asia. What influence did the Middle East and China have on ancient Europe? Ver Gordon Child, 1892 to 1957, an Australian-born archaeologist and philologist, a specialist in language, provided some answers. The son of a Church of England clergyman, he rebelled against his respectable upbringing and became a political activist while still at the University of Sydney. Child then went to study the archaeology of Greece and Rome at Oxford University. After a brief involvement in Australian Labour Party politics, he returned to Britain and then spent 5 years traveling through Europe studying its past. Gordon Child always thought of prehistory as a form of history. His sources were not documents, but the artifacts, sites, and behavior of prehistoric societies. Unlike many earlier archaeologists, he took a very broad view of the past, which contrasted dramatically with the narrow, artifact-based obsessions of other archaeologists. His extensive experience of sites and tools throughout Europe allowed him to build up a portrait of the development of later European societies, starting with farming and ending with the arrival of the Romans. For inspiration, he looked to the ancient societies of the Middle East, whose innovations and ideas had spread into Europe. This idea was nothing new. Child's archaeological predecessors had long believed that civilization had developed in Egypt and Mesopotamia. But Child thought differently from those who assumed that Europe had imported everything new from outside. Whereas Middle Eastern societies had formed larger political units and eventually civilizations, their European contemporaries had fragmented into numerous smaller political units. Child argued that this fragmentation allowed craftspeople and traders to move and spread their ideas and innovations over wide areas. Then, when iron became freely available to all, the first truly democratic states came into being. A fluent writer with an easygoing style, Child wrote a series of widely read books. Most famous was The Dawn of European Civilization, published in 1925, which became a Bible for generations of students right into the 1960s. The Dawn was narrative history based on archaeology. Child talked not of kings and statesmen, but of human cultures identified by groupings of artifacts, such as clay vessels, bronze brooches and swords, and also by architecture and art. He believed that the Danube Basin in Eastern Europe, with its fertile soils and ample rainfall, was the region where many European farming and metal-using societies developed ideas and technologies before these spread westwards towards the distant Atlantic. Child also used artifacts and ornaments to trace changes in human societies through time. This approach is called culture history and has become a basic tool of archaeologists everywhere. His dates for developments such as early farming were, for the most part, closely argued estimates and are now known to be inaccurate. See Chapter 27. In 1927, Child was appointed professor of prehistoric archaeology at Edinburgh University. But he was not a good teacher and instead spent his time traveling and writing. He has relatively few excavations to his name, at around 15 sites in Scotland and Ireland. His most famous dig was that of Scarabray, a Stone Age village in the Orkney Islands off northern Scotland, where he found still intact stone furnishings, now dated to about 3000 BC. These he interpreted by comparing them to the stone furnishings of 19th century rural dwellings in the Scottish Highlands. From artifacts, Child's interests shifted to economic developments in the past, especially agriculture and the origins of civilization. He argued that widespread droughts at the end of the Ice Age had driven human societies into oases. There, they came into contact with wild grasses and wild animals that could be tamed. They turned to farming and animal herding in what he called the Agricultural Revolution. See also Chapter 30. In 1934, he spoke of an urban revolution, which led to the emergence of cities and civilizations. These two revolutions, Child concluded, encouraged major technological advances, produced more food supplies and large population increases, and then ultimately craft specialization, writing, and civilization. He argued that the agricultural and the urban revolutions had as great an impact on human history as did the 18th century industrial revolution, with its steam engines, factories, and cities. In 1946, Child left Edinburgh to become professor of European archaeology at the Institute of Archaeology in London. By the 1950s, though, his ideas were coming under attack. The advent of radiocarbon dating overturned many of his European chronologies. See Chapter 27. Partly on these grounds, a new generation of archaeologists downplayed the influence of the Middle East. New research emphasized internal change in societies rather than external influences. Child became depressed and began to regard his life's work as a failure. Nor did his well-written stories of the past influence the direction of contemporary society. Child retired in 1956, returned to Australia, and committed suicide a year later. To the vigorous and outspoken Gordon Child, we owe some of the first grand narratives of human prehistory, which embraced areas far larger than a single country or region. He, Oriel Stein, and the Chinese archaeologists who worked at Anyang brought together East and West. They turned archaeology into a global study of the past.